Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Hello, this is The Ruck, the rugby podcast from The Times and The Sunday Times. And what a weekend. Harlequins produced one of the great Champions Cup away performances to beat Bordeaux. We're going to be chatting with the Harlequins scrum and forward coach Adam Jones later, whilst Leinster, Northampton and Toulouse also progressed. But it wasn't without controversy. Prior to the weekend, headlines about the Bulls making 13 changes for their trip to Northampton, once again reopening that conversation about how viable is it for South African sides to be in the competition. The Women's Six Nations returned another comfortable win for England, much needed victory for Ireland, and France remain unbeaten as well. So all of that coming up. I'm Alfie Reynolds. Welcome along. And alongside me this week, I've got Alex Lowe. Alex.
Hello.
Tough gig over the weekend.
No, it was a great weekend.
The Bordeaux to lose double.
I did the double down in France and it was glorious. I mean, the weather was glorious, but the rugby was amazing, certainly in Bordeaux, and the way that Toulouse played second half against Exeter. But you just get reminded of why Europe is such a great competition when the Bordeaux team get off the bus and there are flares going up and the drums and the band. Toulouse are walking into the stadium and the ticker tape and the flags and fans have been there for hours. Singing and chanting and incredible colour, great atmosphere.
I saw a lot of things on social media over the weekend of the French just get it.
Yeah, and it's after the game too. I was filing in the stand in Bordeaux and out the back, the band's playing and they're all moved from in the stadium to out the back of the stands and they carry on the party for hours. And the same happened in Toulouse on Sunday. They get it. They stage it brilliantly. Great place to be at the weekend.
Well, straight off the plane, back into Heathrow and onto the pod today. That is the commitment we like to see. Also, Will Kelleher. All right, Will?
Hello. I stayed at home this weekend.
Yeah, nothing quite as exciting for you, was it?
Yeah, I painted some doors. Mm-hmm. And watched a lot of rugby, and it was good.
And thought about having a barbecue, but decided against it.
Yeah,
is what you were telling us earlier.
Yeah, and then walked out of my flat this morning and got soaked. It's very classic April at the moment, isn't it? It's wet.
Yeah,
so, and then sunny, and then wet again.
So far, Alex's intro was far more interesting, but yeah. You can't be blamed for that.
We also bring you the weather on the ruck.
Exactly. And we also, by no means least, have Alan Dimmock back with us, and Dim's a final appearance on the ruck.
Yeah, I don't want to go. By the way, Will had a perfect opportunity there to say, talking about painting the doors, but then didn't Quinns blow the doors off? It was right there for the taking. Yeah, this is, I think this is, never say never, I could come back again.
That's
one
true.
Day, but yeah, there's going to be a change coming up for me. I'm into my last month as editor of Rugby World, so change on the horizon. However, lots of rugby to get stuck into here, plenty to talk about, and it's Alex painted a very rosy picture there about what it's like to watch rugby in France. I think some of what we're going to be talking about with the Champions Cup, though, and what the future should be for that competition might be a little bit more, there'll be a light and shade, a bit more painting chat for Will.
Yeah, quite right. Also, we should say Alex had a great rugby weekend. Recently, you had one of your own as well in Hong Kong.
I actually had a week in Hong Kong, which can feel like a year. I think the Southern Hemisphere commentator Sean Maloney once described doing Hong Kong, the week of the Hong Kong Sevens, as like fighting Ali and Tyson on consecutive nights. It's undefeated as a place. But yeah, went out there. It's the last Hong Kong Sevens in the Hong Kong Stadium there before they moved to a new venue in Kai Tak Sports Centre. 30 years of the Sevens in that arena. First sellout since COVID, which is a big deal. You know, Certainly in Hong Kong, they've been hit a lot harder than a lot of other places with COVID and coming out of that. And my God, has it recovered. Outgoing CEO Robbie McRobbie and his team put on a phenomenal effort there. But it's honestly, I don't know how many times people have said this, but if you've never been to the Hong Kong Sevens, it has to be on your bucket list. Now, there's a whole conversation you can have about the makeup of the Sevens World Series and whether the first year of that has worked, but certainly Hong Kong, my God, there's a reason why it's the jewel in the crown and why rugby fans from all over the world want to go.
I've done it once with a couple of mates, and I've got a friend who was working out there, and we managed to get some tickets. And I think in the South Stand, the famous South Stand, they only sell beers by the litre, basically, don't they? And they're very expensive, and the first one slips down about 7 a.m. and the rugby doesn't start until about 10 or 11. So it's a big day.
The famous saying in the famous saying in Hong Kong is, if you ever get bored of the Sevens, you can turn around and watch the rugby. And I remember, it's funny, this was the first sellout since COVID, and I remember doing it years ago. This is probably my sixth time going to it, and I remember you'd see people queuing to get into the South Stand on the Saturday. Saturday's the big one, because it's a three-day event. Obviously, people have got work on Friday, and then, although there's a weird bank holiday on a Thursday, and then people might take the day off on Friday to go. And on Saturday, people will queue early. I heard someone in the press box that day saying, well, I recommended to my family that they should start queuing at maybe 6 or 7 because it'll get full. And it didn't quite get to full capacity till 9:30, so they were there sort of bouncing around. But it filled up, and my God, like, all sorts going on. It'll be fascinating to see what it's like in the new stadium, because they've never held anything there before. It'll be a new one. But I think over 100,000 people, they said, went through the gates over the 3 days. I mean, it's an anomaly in the most amazing way.
Well, plenty of great memories in Hong Kong revolving around rugby. Our focus this week, as I said in the intro, is going to be the Champions Cup. We will have a wider discussion about the structure of the competition, the South African side's involvement, the various logistical challenges that throws up. As I say, we're going to hear from Adam Jones. Will has been chatting to him, and we'll cover off a few other bits and bobs as well. What do we make of the weekend overall in the Champions Cup?
The closest game was the best game, Bordeaux Quins.
This is kind of what I'm getting at.
And then all the others were blowouts, weren't they, really?
So we've had one unbelievable game, which I'm looking forward to chatting to you about, Alex. And then when I looked at the fixtures coming up, I thought it's going to be three quite one-sided games. I thought Bordeaux Harlequins would have been one of the one-sided ones, and Leinster La Rochelle would have been tighter. So those two have flipped. But I don't know, three very one-sided games, one classic.
It is disappointing. I think Northampton Bulls should have been a belter. Number one team in England against the number one team in South Africa.
Just for the contrast of styles as well.
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. And the quality that the Bulls could have brought into that game, that could have been a belter, and it should have been a showstopper, and it wasn't. It was a real disappointment. And I thought Leinster La Rochelle would be tighter than it ended up being. And like you, Alfie, I thought the English teams would have a tough time down in France. And the way that Quins pulled that game out of the bag, and to have been that far ahead at half time, and all anyone's thinking is the Glasgow game, the Bath game, where they had a big lead and then saw that whittle down to create a tense, dramatic finish. You know, like, the same's going to happen again. You know that Bordeaux are going to come out firing. You know, obviously it could have been different if Bordeaux had had Jalibert and Penaud. You could say if Quins had had Joe Lauch be pulled out in the warm-up, so that unsettled them. It's probably slightly weakened their bench. And Herbst, I thought, had a great game, but you take away that experience. But the way that they dealt with Bordeaux coming back at them twice. Bordeaux came back at them in the first half, and then they pulled away. And then you knew that they were going to come back at them again at the start of the second half. And it didn't rock them. I mean, it rocked them in the sense that they conceded a 16-point lead that went down to 6. But it didn't undermine them. And the way that they rode that, and then just kept testing, kept going. They dropped the ball over the line. They just came again with Dombran and Northmore. And the handling was outstanding. But, of course, the whole thing was underpinned, or driven, actually. Not even underpinned, driven by their scrum and their maul. And I think a lot of the time with Quins, we forget that when they had that awesome run to the title, playing this great rugby and winning these dramatic matches, it was all founded on how good a set piece they had. And they went after Bordeaux. In the scrum and in the maul, scored two maul tries, could have had three. it was just one of those games where, like, it was brilliant in so many different ways because everything worked for them. Do you know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
At any point, there was a different narrative at play, and ultimately, like, Luku made such a difference. And then I actually, what's his name, the wing who came on scored twice, and he rounded far enough under the posts 3 minutes from time that I had my head down, starting to write like notes and work out. Well, I didn't even watch the conversion because I took it as a gimme. And it was only when there was a sort of a hush that I looked up and realised that he'd missed it. And that they hadn't won the game. It's just like a staggering way for it all to finish.
I'm thinking in a slightly wider context of the positivity around the English teams who got through, and maybe all the teams have got through, is that have we seen a fundamental shift here that it's not just defences that win championships now in Europe. You've got to have a blistering attack. Like, all the teams that won over the weekend had a fantastic attacking game, didn't they? And maybe in years gone by, when Saracens were doing well in Europe and they were the sort of flag bearers for the English challenge, it was built on defence.
Strangled
and that's
the life out of a game, yeah.
Whereas, I mean, there are a hell of a lot of points scored, but certainly the two English teams that have got through have got the best attacks, haven't they?
Yeah.
Rather than, I mean, Northampton's defence has improved markedly this season, but Quinn's defence you wouldn't put up there as a like example of possibly how to do it. But Leinster have got a fantastic attack, as we know. Toulouse's attack is like outrageous.
It was, yeah, that was ridiculous.
And so it's just an interesting thing, isn't it? And you wonder whether it will, I don't know, peter down in the semis and particularly the final, depending on who gets there. But at the moment, it's attacks that are winning these games, isn't it? Like, we'll get on to Toulouse Exeter, but blistering second half.
I think Quinns will have to take the same approach against Toulouse.
They've got to swing the bat again, don't they?
Yeah, they use this cricketing analogy of swinging the bat, sort of, which you think is T20 style, just swipe across the line and hope you hit middle and hoik it over Cal Corner. But that's not what they meant. What they meant was
play proper shots, kind of thing.
Play bold, go after the bowling. Go after the bowling, but play proper shots. Yeah, and that's what they.
How far could we see? How far could we take this?
No, but that's what. That's what they did. They weren't reckless about it. They attacked at the right times. They kicked really smartly, and then when they worked out that their hope of going after the set piece was paying off, they kept going at it. That's not reckless.
What I like about that, by the way, and we were talking about this earlier, is not going, oh well, taking off props at this time is what we always do. It's like, no, these guys are going to play 70.
Yeah, yeah. Billy Millard said we just couldn't take them off. Collier and Baxter played 70 minutes together because they were driving the Quinns' effort. Like, they were so important to it. And I just think that's what Quinns will have to do against Toulouse. We know, we'll talk about that game, but the Toulouse bench on Sunday, which had Marchand, Flamand and Thomas Ramos on it.
And Chocobares.
Like, you know, Quinns cannot go, they're not going to go die wandering. They have to go, and whatever analogy and theme they put around that game, it'll be effectively the same thing. Let's go out and do everything that we can do to try and win this game and see where it takes us.
And kind of on that point, Alex, something I wanted to ask all of you is, following the weekend we've just had, has your perceptions changed at all about which of the English sides might be more likely to do it? They're both going to be underdogs to their semi-final. So it's Leinster against Northampton and it's Toulouse against Harlequins. But just from what we saw from Quinns, that throwing everything at it, that kind of attacking game that we've seen previously, has it shifted in any of your minds that you'd, in a weird way, given that both Northampton and Harlequins are such underdogs, give them almost more of a chance of pulling it off?
I feel like Northampton probably have a better shots, which,
yeah, well, I think before the weekend a lot of people would have thought that, because Northampton this year, I mean, they're top of the Premiership, we kind of feel like they've been the most consistent, but I just wonder whether there was anything in the style and the way in which Quinns were able
to
get it done.
Yeah, so with Quinns it's so hard to write them off and predict anything. Like last week I said I don't think they've got the minerals to win anything, and then they go and do that on Saturday and you think, well, fair enough. But then you watch Toulouse on the Sunday and you just go, is there any team in the world that attack like that and in that sort of savage nature of scoring, not just like a couple of tries in a row, but six, and just going, any line break, we've scored a try. It's like old school All Blacks efficiency in that.
It was brutal. And Exeter went after them as much as they could in the first half, and they made life difficult for them at the breakdown. The Exeter back row were excellent, I thought, and just disrupted Toulouse's fluidity, forced some errors. Intermac dropped a simple pass, which led ultimately to a try for the Chiefs. But as Toulouse sort of worked out what was going on, Jack Willis began to really take control. I thought he was outstanding in competing on the floor, but getting them going forward. His carrying game was unbelievable. He carried further than any other Toulouse player and beat more defenders than any other Toulouse player, partly because none of the backs actually really had to beat anyone. They just sort of passed their way through the Chiefs. But that's all connected. Because they were winning that battle, and the Chiefs play, they try and defend sort of England style, try and up and put the pressure on. But they were young and inexperienced and knackered, frankly, that Toulouse were just able to use their skills and get around them every time. So your best bet of stopping that is to have as much energy in defence as they have sharpness in attack and try and shut it down. And Exeter just didn't have it. And Toulouse scored those four tries in 10 minutes straight after half time. And the final score was pretty much what I expected. I think Exeter will have left having scored 26 points in Toulouse, which is with a rookie team, frankly, which is something to hold on to. I mean, it sounds odd given they lost by 40, but this is a team that's ahead of schedule. They shouldn't have been in the last eight of Europe, because then they're not there yet. But this will help them. But yeah, Toulouse that how devastating they were on the back of the work that people like Jack Willis did in the last hour of the game. Just outstanding.
So I'm reliably informed by Paul Edison, who knows all things French rugby, that this is six semis in a row for Toulouse.
Mm.
Never been done before by that. And I'm not sure. I mean, email in if you know if anyone's done anything similar. But that is a hell of an effort. But, you know, Alex said, or forgive me, it might have been Will that said, that the English teams will be underdogs for these semis. Well, potentially it's looking at the two teams with the greatest depth are the favourites, and we're sort of, if everything goes to script, then it will look like it's a Leinster Toulouse final, and by a distance, those are in terms of quality of cattle that they've got to pick from. No one else in Europe can touch those two teams, can they?
That's where I think they're. It was always, I think, in this tournament going to be how far can the English teams get before that depth thing then becomes a problem for them. And like Toulouse can compete on two fronts to try and win the top 14 as well. But you're looking at what Quins have got next. They are trying to get into the top four of the Prem. They've got a massive game in big summer kickoff match against Northampton at Twickenham that they'll need to win, and so will Northampton. So they can't. They have rotated. I mean, they didn't have Danny Kerr and Joe Marler, but that's going to be an issue. And they've actually brought some guys back, haven't they? Because they had Cunningham South and Jared Evans who returned. But
so,
you think that at some point that'll probably be exposed, and it'll be when, I suppose.
Just as a side note, if you're an England coach watching that Harlequins team play, you would be rubbing your hands because Cunningham South set the tone for them.
Yeah.
In the first 15 minutes,
he was awesome.
His first attempt to carry, he ran an unbelievable line and then dropped it in contact. Second carry, it took four defenders to bring him down. Third carry took three defenders. Next time he got the ball, they stationed three men on him and he threw it out the back. And Quins got around the edge and nearly scored. And he set the tone for Quins, a bit like Willis did actually for Toulouse. Unbelievable. I thought Will Porter, all the talk of the week was Danny Kerr has been rested. Will Porter comes in and shows what he could. He was outstanding as well. So there was lots to be excited about.
Faye Wabosa as well in the Exeter game. Like,
yeah.
I can't believe how many defenders
he
gets through.
Yeah, definitely. And so I thought the bench, I thought the depth they were talking about would count against Quins, and they refused to allow it to. Maybe because, as Al says, they reacted to what they were seeing, and these guys, the starters, were working. They forced Bordeaux to make all these changes because their scrum was being dismantled, and so stick with it for as long as you can. It was always going to come into play in the Toulouse game. And I think, you know, on more of a newsy front, the salary cap goes up next year. There'll be attempt. You know, we know that most clubs don't want it to, but those clubs that do want it to will be the ones who will be looking to challenge in the later stage of these competitions, Saracens, Bath in particular. What will that do to help strengthen some of the benches of these clubs? But can they afford to do it? And we're back into that cycle again of, can English clubs actually afford to compete with, you know, Leinster, which is sort of the crown jewel of the Irish structure, and then just the grand teams like Toulouse and the money that they have.
Just on a very quick point on the money, my understanding is that Northampton haven't paid up to the salary cap for 10 years, which makes what they're doing even more remarkable and such a credit to their system and the coaching and the players that they've so obviously improved.
It puts a huge emphasis on on the academy system being right and finding a way to bring through the under-18s players and the under-20 players and actually promote them into senior teams, which is actually there was a foundation point of where France have been so good. With the GIF system, guys like Dupont and Aldrete were given top 14 game time. We're seeing it now with Tuolangi, top 14 game time way before their English equivalents. But I think that's going to have to change as well with guys like, you see, you know, this current generation, Finn Baxter, but the guys a couple of years below him in the front row, for example, Asha Poku Fojor is a good example of that. These guys are going to need, they're going to have to give these players game time because they can't afford to recruit in the way that they did before.
And the topic of squad depth, I think, quite nicely brings us on to the situation with the Bulls, who made a number of changes for their game with Northampton, caused a huge amount of discussion about the viability of South African teams in the competition and the various logistical issues that come with the travel, etc. So up next, we'll get into that. We'll ask the question, does having South African sides in the Champions Cup work? So the Bulls, fresh off beating Lyon at home, are tasked with a trip to Northampton in the quarterfinal, 13 changes and then meltdown on social media. But understandably, a lot of discussion about everything that I outlined just before, Will. We were saying last week that it would make quite a good talking point of how does it work? Can it work? All the various issues. I mean, where on earth can we start with this kind of work?
Well, I think we're all going to sort of try and debate the whys and wherefores of it, but trying to be constructive with it as well, because I don't think there's much point just saying let's just get rid of the South African teams, because it's not happening and the sort of genie's out of the bottle there. So there's kind of, it's a bit of a moot point, so let's try and find a way of it working, because at the moment I would say on and off the field it's currently not working as it should be. The intention was for South African teams to fly to Europe on business class flights overnight, no time difference. That was the sell. And they'd bring so much more vibrancy to the competition. They would make the rugby go through the roof. They would make sponsorship deals go through the roof. They would make TV deals go through the roof. And it sort of hasn't happened yet. So my understanding is there's yet to be a TV deal signed for next season. TNT yet, they haven't agreed a deal. So we're not necessarily seeing that drive for broadcasters to go, we've got to be part of this competition. It's so brilliant that we need to spend more money on it. If, in fact, the TV deal, when it gets agreed, is probably going to be similar or less than it was before. So there'll be lots of metrics that we can get through and talk through, but I think it's worth being constructive, but also realising that at the moment, this thing isn't working on and off the field. So how could we improve it, essentially?
Which is different, perhaps, to the second sides in the URC, and Dims, I know you can probably speak about this, where there has been a kind of material benefit.
And that's why Will's right, the genie is out of the bottle, because there's no dancing around the fact that the URC has been improved by the introduction of the South African teams, and they took to it lickety-split. Like, they jumped in and made a big difference, particularly the Stormers and the Bulls.
Is that because the South African side won it in the first season, do you think?
Well, yes, but it was just the overall level of competition. They were so hungry to be involved, and it was such a contrast. I mean, you can get into the machinations of how the URC makes any sense anyway, from all these different nationalities and teams with their different traditions fitting together. But to add in a competitive element suddenly made the games mean more. And they were, after all that they'd been through with Super Rugby, you could tell that a lot of these teams were just happy to be involved in something that, even just from a time zone, I mean, I'm sure the people of Supersport are very, very happy to have had that those time differences come in there so they could show more on television. And by the way, just on European rugby, that's the argument I imagine you'll get from the other side, is that the Investec sponsorship wouldn't have been there if the South African teams weren't involved, and a Supersport deal for television is probably pretty good for the people of URC. The argument really is, though, is that is having that prop up the game good enough for the product that it is? And the current issue of Rugby World magazine, we've got a big feature where we made a point of speaking to players all around the world about what they see as important issues within the game. For this, I asked a couple of them, I went back, I ran it back, and I said to them, Europe, what do you make of Europe at the moment? One of them, a very high-profile name, said, didn't watch a minute of the games at the weekend. Doesn't push my buttons anymore. Not really that fussed. Another one said, well, I can tell you what a lot of my colleagues who are professional players think. The format is too hard to understand. A lot of people, particularly in France and in certain parts of England, are pissed off about the inclusion of the South African teams because it's adding in all the extra layers, travel chaos that Will touched on there, completely. And then there's the element of the prestige. So how do you square that circle? And I'm sure we can talk an awful lot about it now, because I know that Alex and Will have been scribbling in their notepads about how you fix Europe, what it is. But at the moment, there's a real view from players that it doesn't really work. And for me, I don't think it has the same butterfly in his tummy effect it had when it was the Heineken Cup, back when it felt properly elite.
There's an acknowledgement from the EPCR that it's not working. I mean, they can't pretend otherwise. And I think there's a set. They want to stay patient because they want to give the South African audience time to understand why the Champions Cup is so important and so well regarded in Europe. My issue with that is, why are you bringing teams and a rugby nation into a competition who don't already respect it? Al, you said they took to the URC straight away. They wanted to be involved in it. We're getting so many mixed messages from South Africa about whether or not they want to be involved in the Champions Cup, whether they care about it. You only have to look at the Bulls, who play in a prestigious, enormous stadium, attracting 7,000 people for a round of 16 game.
It's an interesting point from Alex as well, because a lot of these teams, you're right, they need to decide what they want, because they're having one squad that will play 11-month seasons, including friendlies and stuff like that, to be involved in the URC, the Champions or Challenge Cup, and the Currie Cup. And it's like one of these sacred cows, at some point you're going to have to take out back.
So I think the starting point for our conversation is it is not working, and for a variety of reasons. From a rugby reason, there's no way why South African teams coming in shouldn't improve the quality on the field like they have in the URC, as Al says. The problem is they're not as committed to it as they need to be in order to deliver that. And I talked about what a glorious experience it was going to Toulouse and Bordeaux, and that will have bled through the TV screens back home. Will was watching on telly. You can see the colour and the passion and the fervour and the joy. You don't get any of that coming back from South Africa at all. So they don't add anything to the romance of it. No one's got a everyone's got a connection with Toulouse or Bordeaux or even Racing with a Space Age Stadium. No one's got a connection with these teams, and so it takes more to make it feel like they're actually part of this competition and not just an add-on. And that's where we are now, and that's what EPCR have to solve. They have to, and I wrote a piece Friday when the Bulls and Eight confirmed what we suspected, which is that 11 Springboks are being left at home, saying that EPCR, who've never had any teeth in dealing with teams fielding weakened sides in the pool stages to the point where it's become accepted now that rotation is required in the pool stages, that some action has to be taken, whether it's punishing the Bulls, which I don't think is going to happen. I think politically that's too difficult. And all, I think they need to take ownership themselves and look at the schedule, look at the dates, and not give these teams any excuse but to take it seriously and treat it as the pinnacle competition.
And this is something that we were speaking about before then, Will. I feel like, Alex, that naturally leads us on to, as we've said already, it's not going to change. How can it be improved? And does it come down to the structure?
Yeah, and I think at this juncture as well, there's a point that South Africans would like us to make, which is a fair point, is that many teams in the history of the Champions Cup, English, French and otherwise, have sent bad teams, lambs to the slaughter, but not in a quarter final. But we've had years gone by where Gloucester, Quins, Bath, Montpellier, Cast, Stade Francais have all basically thrown games.
Northampton did it themselves against Leinster.
But not in a quarter final.
Not in a quarter final.
Which is the difference. And the other difference is the fact that South Africa is 8,000 miles away, which is never going to change either. We can't change the geography of the world. So I think the thing that they would, because punishments won't work, because how do you nail down what a first choice 15 is or 23, and a coach
probably
will go,
includes 11 Springboks.
Well, yeah, but a coach will go, Springboks. I was like Jake White did. I've got 50-50s on injuries, which there's quite widespread scepticism about that as a reason. And we'll see what team they pick for Munster this Saturday back at home. So you can't really go, we're going to police it hard, and we're going to give big sanctions and all that. Not going to work. So I think the only real way they can do it is to split apart the last 16, if they're going to keep a last 16, and quarterfinals, because where this becomes a major issue is these back-to-back knockout games where you don't know where you're going next week, and the Bulls, for example, could have been at home or in England, you suddenly have to rush.
So without getting bogged down in spreadsheets and calendars, what's happened is during COVID, EPCR gave a week back to the leagues, which meant that the weekends for the EPCR competitions went from 9 to 8. Now they're out of COVID, they can't get that weekend back. So they can't run pool stages as they were, so they're having to try and find a way of working. EPCR feel that they are now happy with the compromise that was that's been made with the groups as they were, which were bigger than they used to be, but teams don't play rivals from the same league. They're relatively content now with that group stage, and I think with the round of 16. Last season, they tried to persuade the three leagues to allow them to separate the round of 16 and the quarterfinal as the semi-final and final are, and that was blocked by the leagues because the leagues want blocks of matches. They don't want teams jumping from one competition to the other, which I do get, because you're trying to market something, and as you were saying, if people don't understand that the format of something, it's not going to help if you're jumping from one competition to another. So the leagues blocked it. I wonder whether what's happened this weekend, I suspect it will strengthen the arm of EPCR to go back to the leagues, three leagues, and go, this cannot continue. We have to have time in between the round of 16 and the quarterfinals, because it's been highlighted by the Bulls selection. But, you know, the ticket sales for these games was strong, I thought, for the quarterfinals. The ticket sales were strong, but they could have been stronger. There was a section in Bordeaux that wasn't sold out. They don't have a huge amount of time to sell tickets. Now, I thought with a six-day turnaround, they did really well. Give them 2 weeks or 3 weeks, these games, with proper marketing, these games are packed. But more than that, you have time to sell hospitality and activate sponsorships. It's actually worth a lot more money to the leagues and the clubs if they have more time to sell these games. And on your point, what about the TV? Why would TNT commit to something when the prime time game on Saturday night, the number one team in the Premiership v the number one team in South Africa, is denuded to the point where I don't know anyone who sat down and watched it, because you know what's going to happen. It's not the pinnacle. And so what EPCR are going to focus on, rather than, I think, than punishing teams over their selection, is to go, well, let's not give them any excuse but to treat the Champions Cup as the pinnacle. And they have to take, for me, they have to take firm action. Part of the problem with these governing bodies in rugby is that Premiership have had it, and they're wrestling to gain centralised control over the league, because they're just there to represent the clubs below them. EPCR are there to represent the leagues below them. But at some point, they have to take firm control of it and go, this competition, like Super Rugby, like what happened to Super Rugby, which was like revered, and then it became bloated and overcomplicated, and it lost its soul. And it lost what it was. And the Champions Cup is in serious danger of following the same slide unless EPCR can take a firm grip of it.
This is a pet subject of mine, is governing bodies that are afraid to be the bad guy help no one. Sometimes you've got to make a tough decision and suffer the slings and arrows. And this is one of those occasions where, guess what? There's going to be people that are mighty pissed off. Crack on.
So speaking to some South Africans over the last few days to try and get their sense of it too, they were expecting a backlash. And actually, there are people in South Africa who go, look, this is really not a good look. And someone put it to me, it's like being invited to someone's party and then taking a wee on the floor. Like, we're lucky to be here, and then we're going and ruining everything. So I think for the South Africans, some of it comes down to squad depth, which is what we came back to with the English sides, and something Jake White mentioned after the game on Saturday night. So my understanding is that the top end South African teams will spend about £4 million equivalent on their squad, which is, if you factor in the cost of living between England and South Africa, is probably about comparable with what Northampton are spending on their squad. It's nowhere near what Glasgow are spending on their squad. It's nowhere near what the French teams are spending on their squad, but it's a challenge the English teams have too. And as Al said before, these South African teams are competing in lots of different competitions. Like, I was down in Cape Town last year where Brock Harris, the old prop, played in two games in one afternoon. They went and played for Western Province after having just played Quins. That's the level of thinness they've got in some of these squads. So that's part of the reason why they can't necessarily believe they can bring the best teams up here. And also, the point that Jake White made is that they don't recruit. They don't have foreigners who come and play in South Africa, or if they do, very limited, like Ben Loder plays for the Stormers, but they don't have a raft of Polynesians like the French teams do, like the English teams do. So some of it is learning what it takes to compete on two fronts, I think, which is what all teams go through. But the thing with South Africa is just this endless travel problem is a nightmare for them, which is something that the English don't have to do that.
They have to sort that out, don't they, in terms of some sort of direct flights, because at the moment they're having to 100%. Go different flights to Qatar and back. Like, it's an absolute nightmare.
So Qatar Airways are a sponsor or a partner via South African Rugby of EPCR, and they help sort South Africans coming up north, and EPCR help sort Northern Hemisphere teams go south. Largely, the Northern Hemisphere teams kind of sort themselves, because a few of them have got partners, sponsors like DHL that help them out and all that sort of thing. And actually, EPCR help fund the European clubs by making sure they're not out of pocket. So they'll spend about 50 to 70 grand to travel away from home, and they'll make it up for them if it's more to go to South Africa, whereas it's not equivalent the other way around. They pin it on South African rugby to sort the South African travel. But if Qatar are going to be a proper sponsor, they need to be told, and who's going to tell them this, you need to hold flights for us. You need to make sure that these are available. We can't have a situation where we're basically going on Skyscanner and going, oh, they're all booked. That doesn't work. That doesn't work for the competition. If they're a proper partner for them, they need to be told to help them out more, because at the moment it doesn't work. You can't have half the team going via Switzerland and KLM and Amsterdam and Paris. It's just ludicrous.
So sorting the travel, I think, is one thing. What's some of the other solutions? I know we got an email in from Doug Johnston to theruck@thetimes.co.uk, who I think, Will, is thinking along similar lines to you in terms of structure. But he said, if you want to find a way to facilitate the South African teams playing in Europe, there's a short-term solution and a longer-term one. He said, next season, the knockouts need to be spaced out, which is, Alex, what you've mentioned already. He suggests two pool weekends in October, two pool weekends early December, round of 16 late January, quarter-final April, semi-final early May, final late May, early June. Will, I know you've been doing some scribbling and trying to work this out.
He's been reading my notepad, because this is exactly the season structure that I came up with on the weekend, just doodling. And that would bring back what people really loved of those back-to-back games where you go away and then home against someone in December particularly. That was always the thing, wasn't it? But in my scenario, I would get rid of the last 16, because he's got there.
Is he keeping it as a 2014 competition?
Well, this is the thing, because I think in order to, I've said this for years, but in order to make it work more simply, you need to reduce the amount of teams in the competition, which would then make the Challenge Cup enormous.
Make it elite. You know, stop trying to satisfy as many markets by having X number of people from. Like, how many people is it from England?
So 8 of the 10 Premiership clubs qualify for the Champions Cup. It's nonsense. Yeah, it's too many, in my view.
My thing on that potential structure is that we're all still dancing around with this idea of a season where it's called, we've got a little pocket of games here for your club, and then there's a different competition with this club here. Oh, and then there's a test window, and then there's another two little pockets here, and it's all put in the same cocktail shaker and shaken up. For me, everything needs to be a lot more simple. I'm coming off a long run here now. Everything needs to be a lot more simple. And this is not a way of slagging off supporters or the way that we digest our entertainment these days. But and we're always at risk of the grass is always greener and people talking about American sports all the constant time. But there are certain parts of the world where the sporting calendar is pretty clear. It's pretty obvious. Like, that's basketball season there, there's NFL season, there's college basketball season there, there's all this kind of stuff. It fits together. In Australia, you're nodding at me. I'm imagining there's an element of that as well. Alfie, okay, Alfie's nodding. Sure. And with rugby union, it's just all chucked in the tumble dryer, and then we see what comes out at the end of it. And it would be great if we just went, make everything that little bit more elite, where we have a huge block where it's like, the league is what matters the most, and guess what? You get your players for a lot longer. Then, super intense, lot shorter amount of teams, properly elite European competition, where winning that really means something. And then, of course, we have the test windows, which are ring-fenced. Now, I know that I've just very quickly just gone, here's the problem that rugby union has faced since professionalism, but my God, would it not solve so many more problems?
For that to happen, EPCR have to become the governing body that runs all club rugby in Europe, to the point where they go, right, here's your season structure, go and play your domestic competition, then we'll have the Six Nations, and then we'll have the Champions Cup and the Challenge Cup after the Six Nations. They would have to dictate downwards, because, as we know, 30 years worth of everyone sitting around a conference table just doesn't get anyone anywhere because the top 14 have their traditions and a long season, and URC is trying to expand into different markets, and then the Premiership's just lost three teams and everyone's fighting their own domestic challenges. And so it's, yeah, your utopian view, Al, is exactly that. There's just absolutely no way.
So here's a possible way that I haven't written this on my pad like my other structure, which is a bit more sort of cocktail shaker throwing it about. But the way you probably could do it is you kind of have your domestic season in three thirds. So you have a bit between September and November, then you play your autumn internationals, you have a bit around Christmas and January, then you have your Six Nations, and then you have a bit after and finish it by May. Then afterwards, you do sort of what they're thinking about doing with the Club World Cup. You say the elite teams who have just all finished their leagues then play in like a six-week block. That's the European Cup or the Champions Cup, the Challenge Cup. And it's based off the leagues that have just finished. So then you sort of have this league season that builds to then having a European champion, and then you go and play your summer tour. And you could fiddle around with the weeks and stuff like that, so you're not having this flip between. You do it a bit more like New Zealand rugby, where you sort of build from your provincial stuff to your franchise stuff to your test stuff, like that.
Have we talked about the Club World Cup on
we this? Did last week, yeah, a bit, but I think that's going to cause more issues like
I like the idea of the European champions playing the Super Rugby champions, which is effectively what they do in rugby league, right? And I'm pretty sure,
like Penrith Wigan kind of
sure that they expanded that into a series and it didn't work, and it's come back down to a showpiece event to kick off both league seasons. And I'd be on board with a one-off game. I'm not sure.
What could you do, like a State of Origin sort of start three-match series.
We're just adding more games to the calendar. Again, it comes back to my defining point here, is just make it more elite. Like, we're scrambling around going, well, TNT don't think this is quite attractive enough to put their hands in the pocket for more than they've already been spending. There's not a queue of people outside the door trying to get it. Well, guess what? Stop trying to satisfy all these different markets and cramming in all these different people, and just go, right, you know what? Who's the best of the best? Because I'll tell you what, that will be much more entertaining on television. Absolutely. And then it'll be much more likely for people to want to buy rights to it.
Well, I don't know how many questions we were able to answer there. It's a difficult old subject. But if you want to give us your views, then theruck@thetimes.co.uk is the best place for you to email. And we might get to some of them in next week's episode. Next up, though, we teed him up earlier following that incredible win in Bordeaux. We're going to hear from the Harlequins scrum and forwards coach, Adam Jones.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Okay, so great to be joined by Adam Jones, the scrum coach, forwards coach for Harlequins. And Adam, let's start. How on earth are you after that result in Bordeaux? What an amazing victory that was.
Oh, look, one of the great games, I think. You know, we expected them how to play, how they played, and, you know, they caused us some issues. But there's a few bits we could have done better. But, oh, look, he was, as a pack of forwards, although, you know, we did incredibly well, both in the scrum and the maul and stopping their maul. So we were, you know, as a pack, we were really pleased with that. But, like, as I said, it was one of the great games I'm involved in, you know, right down to the wire, literally. And, yeah, look, what a performance. And, you know, probably up there, I'd imagine, with Quinn's best ever ones, really.
How were the celebrations? Did you allow... I was chatting to Will Evans last week, and he was saying that he had Monday off and he was planning a trip to Bordeaux Vineyard. But you're back in Guildford already, are you? You haven't...
No, look, we flew back straight after the game. I think we got a longer week this week with, obviously, Sale next Sunday. So, you know, it was nice to... Yeah, I guess just nice to get back. And then, you know, I don't know what the boys did yesterday. But, you know, it was, you know, because we're not in today as the players aren't in. So, no, look, hopefully they've taken time to celebrate, really. You know, recover. I'm sure they've recovered. But, you know, celebrating is, you know, so getting to, I think they get together, you know, stay pretty tight around it. And, you know, these type of games don't often come around. And, you know, certainly... And then to the European semi-final, or, you know, the main competition, which club has never done before, you know, it's pretty special. And there's not many in our group who've done it either. So, you know, I think it's only Billy Millard with Cardiff back in the day, Joe Lawrencebury, I think Brina, one of the physios with Munster. So there's not, you know, there's not many people who have got to a semi-final in this club. And so it's, you know, it's an amazing achievement for them.
Your area went well, which is a bit of an understatement. Like, particularly Finn Baxter and Will Collier were absolutely sensational, weren't they, against a fairly large set of props from Bordeaux. Can you just talk to me about just how proud you were of that effort, maybe particularly from Finn, who's so young and still kind of learning his trade as a prop, isn't he? And you helped him move across from one side to the other, but that was one of his great days, wasn't it?
Yeah. Oh, look, he's only 22, so, you know, he hasn't, you know, I'm sure he's got plenty to come, but, you know, doing that on that stage, you know, at that age is, you know, it's pretty special. And, oh, look, it was a massive collective effort. We, you know, we only did two live scrums in the week in build-up, you know. So it wasn't, you know, it was more around just getting the sort of, you know where they're going to come with, but now just getting as a pack of forwards, just getting everyone emotionally right. You know, physically we'd be fine, you know, we spend a lot of time on technique and whatnot, and, you know, and sometimes you don't need to go out there and do 80 scrums on a Tuesday or Thursday or God knows many in the machine or whatever it is. You know, sometimes it was just probably more getting the boys emotionally right. And, you know, Finn was brilliant. He's, I don't know, 2.5 years maybe into playing Lucid. So he's, you know, he's very diligent. He, you know, he works hard in training. He's good around the analysis. He's good around, like, putting plans into place. He'll obviously have tougher days, you know, so, you know, you're only as good as your last game. But, you know, the way, you know, as a player as well, he's a phenomenal rugby player.
What are the kind of technical challenges for him that you were talking about in the week when you come across someone that is just so big in Ben Tamafuna, 25 stone? He seemed to get underneath him so well and drive him back. I mean, Will Collier had lots of success on his side too, didn't he?
Yeah, I think, you know, as across the hall, you know, it's, you know, Jack Walker in the middle, Ernie, Steph, you know, remember Launch has pulled out in the warm-up. You know, the front five, you know, scrimmed real well, real hard as well. And we knew... I think we probably, the first scrum of the game, we had our ball near the touch and we, you know, Finn popped out with Funa, and, you know, and after that I was like, oh, this could be interesting. It's a massive part of the game, and pretty, you know, it's I guess it was one of those ones, and especially as a scrum coach and a bit of a purist, you know, there wasn't, you know, like in that atmosphere, in that crowd, we talked about all week about like silencing them around, you know, if the scrum gets on top, the crowd gets behind them, and it's, you know, it's a massive, it was a massive, you know, challenge for us to go out there. You know, silence the scrum, crowd, especially on the scrum.
How fundamental has that been for you since you've been the scrum coach at Quinns? Like, when you won the title in 21, it was largely based off Marler and Wilco Lowe, wasn't it? And Collier too, of dominating the scrum, having, I think, one of the cleanest scrums in the Prem at that point. Your stats are still pretty good, and it allows your attacking players to do what they do as well, doesn't it? You've got to have that platform.
Yeah, like we're probably not. In our mind, you know, because we've got the backs, we have, you know, Marcus, you know, Andre, or, you know, whoever we've got in the backs, you know, we're not one of these teams who just scrum for penalty every scrum, you know, which, you know, a lot of teams do, and that's a massive strength of them, and it's up to you then to coach our team to, you know, avoid that, not avoid that, but to, like, nullify that and nullify the threat. So it's, you know, and that's on me as a scrum coach when we play the teams who just want to scrum for penalties. You know, how do we plan around that to, you know, match them, you know, get parity so they don't win it. So, you know, we work at probably at the moment that sort of 96%, 97% all win in the Premiership, which I think is the highest. And, you know, that's what we try to aim for every season. You know, the penalties kind of will take care of themselves, you know, but we don't want to be losing ball on our ball. We don't want to be giving penalties away. We want clean ball. We want, and then when we need the scrum, we scrum. Or when we want the scrum, you know, when certain times of the game, I'd be an absolute you know, I'd be the worst scrum coach in the world if I realised we just won the scrum every scrum threat of a penalty every time, because when you got Danny Kerr, Will Porter, Marcus Smith, Jared Evans, Andre Estes, you know, all these guys, you know, you want to give them the ball. So, you know, Tyrone Green, wherever it is, you know, we want to give them the ball, and scrum is it's a big part of the game.
Two questions to finish for you, Adam, before I let you go. Just particularly on Finn, like, everyone's excited about his potential. Do you think he'd be ready already to go on tour with England in the summer? Like, he seemed to be the next cab off the rank at Loosehead behind the three they had with...
I think so. I think, look, he's a great player. It's, what I will say, with the young props coming through with England, that was pretty... You know, if I was the English scrum coach, I'd be licking my lips, the sort of the succession plan then after, you know, Marla, after, you know, Mako and, you know, these guys, you know, the kid of Sale, you know, there's a couple of boys in
Northampton. Asher, yeah.
There's a couple of boys in Northampton. There's good players coming, good prop, Bevan Rod at Sale as well. You know, he's been around, he seems like he's been around for about 5 years, and he's only about 23, 24 himself, so, you know, good player. And so he, you know, there's a lot of depth there coming through, young depth in England, which is amazing, really. So, you know, it's brilliant for the English rugby team, and yeah, hopefully we'll keep, you know, a couple coming through with us, and hopefully we'll keep developing them for the English team as well. So, you know, England, but, you know, if Finn was ready, Finn was asked to go now, he's more than ready. Now, he's got the sort of work rate, he's got the intent in his tackling, his carry, he's the best handler in front row I've seen. I'd put him on a par with, he wouldn't get this, but I'd put him on a par of how good his hands were with Duncan Jones. Like, Duncan back in the day had unreal hands, you know, and so I'd put Finn on a par with him. So, for me, that's a pretty big compliment. But no, of course he's ready to go. He's ready to get ready to go.
And thinking about you yourself as well, like, you must just be so incredibly proud of how those guys are growing at Quinns. What are you thinking about for your future? Like, I'm thinking about next summer, and there's a Lions job on the line, isn't there? I wonder if you could had to send a little text to Andy Farrell and say, did you see my boy scrummaging on the weekend?
Yeah, no, look, it's a funny one. It's, I don't know whether, you know, obviously if Faz wanted to take me, I'd bite his hand off, and, you know, I think...
Yeah.
I'm 100% Hent could do a job as a scrum coach for the Lions, you know. So it's a funny one with the Lions, isn't it? As a scrum coach, you're not going to change a lot of technique because, you know, these are the sort of the best props in the home union. So, you know, there's not a lot you can do, you know, so around that, but... No, if that job ever came, then I'd bite the hand off with it. It's, you know, I've been going twice as a player, you know, then, you know, I don't think there's many, Lions, ex-Lions players coaching any teams and doing the scrum anyway. So maybe I could, was it Yayan Ems, is he chairman this year?
Yeah.
I'll give Yayan a ring, see if he can sort me out.
Well, you've put your hat in the ring pretty nicely there with your players doing so well on the weekend. Great to have you on the pod, Adam, and all the best for when you get there for Toulouse, because you'll have a crack at them, might as well.
Yeah,
never going to die wondering, Quinns, are you?
No, exactly. You know, they didn't look too bad yesterday, to be fair to them. So it's extra. But, I don't. We'll go there, we'll give it a crack. We'll definitely go and have a crack in the scrum, you know, and see what happens at the end of the game.
Awesome, Adam. Well, good luck for the weekend, and brilliant performance. Well played. Thanks very much for coming on.
Good month. Cheers, bye.
So, Women's Six Nations, we'll do a little bit now. We've also got a standalone pod coming up on Thursday where myself, Will Elgin, are going to be in the Red Roses camp chatting to John Mitchell, Ellie Kildun, a few of the other players as well. So, looking forward to that.
We're trying to do these specials. We did our last sort of big special was at Christmas with Sale, which hopefully went down well. And we'll try and do another couple before the end of the season. But it's nice to give the Red Roses a bit of love. They've got Ireland coming to Twickenham with Sophie Ellis-Bextor. I bet Alex is really looking forward to hearing a bit of that.
Murder on the Dance Floor.
Yeah. That's come back a bit, hasn't it? That was 2002, 2003? Some of those players in the Red Roses wouldn't have been alive.
There was a real carry them home, take me home thing that you could have worked in there, but you just
I do feel there's an intro in there as England put 70 points on Ireland.
But that would be interesting to talk to John Mitchell and guys like that. It's a thing we come through in lots of different sports, having it in F1 at the moment, aren't you? Like, does the sport suffer if the dominant team's too dominant? And are we just going around the houses every season to wait for the Black Ferns to play the Red Roses in a World Cup final and see who wins it?
And it's such a difficult thing for them in the Red Roses camp to answer, because it's not their fault, they're more professional.
But that's
why
I wonder whether John Mitchell will have an interesting sort of, as we'd say in the business world, like, helicopter view of it, having been a men's coach and having coached the All Blacks and seen it in different areas of the world. Of, do we need women's sport? Because it is competitive underneath that in different ways, isn't it? But when you have a team that's so well funded and dominating everyone and thrashing everyone, does it actually make the sport better or worse? It's not the Red Roses' fault. Everyone needs to catch up with them, but how feasible is that?
What I would say is, you know, Scotland got handily beaten by the Red Roses just at the weekend gone there. But for them, it's competition that in this one is about the battles within the battles. So, for example, if Scotland win two matches this Six Nations, that's a really good return for them. If they happen to win three matches, that's an unbelievable year. And if you the added spice to this one is if you finish in the top three for the Women's Six Nations, that's World Cup qualification. So for someone like Scotland to automatically, they've got two big games to come, and certainly no one's getting ahead of themselves in Scotland. But for them, you know, there's a really big carrot dangling in front of them. And so, yes, they were handily dealt with by the Red Roses, but there's lots still to play for them, and that's where we are with the Women's Six Nations at the moment.
And that's where you also are looking at the Welsh performances, and you're going, that's almost becoming a new story in itself of not only the men's team of the Wooden Spooners, but the women's team are now can't win either. Like, I wonder what's going on there. Like, thrashed by Ireland, and you're seeing some Welsh fans on social media just going, that's one of the worst performances I've ever seen. Like, so there are stories away, obviously, away from the Red Roses, aren't there? But yeah, those battles within battles, you wonder like how competitive they can keep becoming over future years.
I think there might be an announcement coming this week, but the Women's Lions, I think, could be a vehicle to help generate new funding revenue, investment revenue. I think there may be an announcement coming, but the Women's Lions concept for a tour in 2027 is an opportunity to open new funding avenues, which might then help the WRU, the Irish Rugby Union, Scotland to invest more into their women's pathway programmes, and that might help accelerate ultimately the national team's performance. That's probably with an idea of getting a wider spread of players on that Lions tour, but the knock-on effect could be felt through the Six Nations in hopefully fairly quickly.
Well, special pod with the Red Roses coming up later this week. That will be in your Ruck podcast feed, so make sure you keep an eye out for it. And England, of course, with their game against Ireland this coming weekend at Twickenham. Not expecting quite the record crowd that we saw when they hosted France, but nonetheless, no doubt a bumper fixture for them as well. So looking forward to that. Let's finish off the pod, shall we, with God or Goddess of the Week, Dims?
I'm actually going to jump in with a... with an angelic moment.
Oh, go on.
He's leaving and now he's adding format points to the
55th minute. Toulouse just cut loose with, I lost count of the number of offloads for their try, but King Blairhorn finished it off in the corner, one of two tries for him. But it was just, it was one of those where it was like, that is what we love to see from a team like Toulouse when they're firing on all cylinders. And it was just like one of those where you just sort of felt it coming up from your diaphragm. Yes! Yes, that's what we want to see.
Rugby. So, but you don't have a god,
general. Moment. It was just, I've jumped off a bit there.
Well, you were actually in France, yeah. So I'll let you choose someone, and then I'll.
Well, when you said the angelic moment, I thought you were nicking Finn Baxter off everyone. It's this sort of cherubic prop forward who plays for.
I would
Quinns.
Never dare call a prop forward.
I thought Paul. I don't know how you pronounce his name. Paul.
Cost?
Is it just Cost?
Oh, yeah.
Who was involved in pretty much every Toulouse try and was involved in one you're discussing. His handling was just extraordinary. That was angelic.
I have actually got his name written down here because I want to give him a slight mention. Is there's a feeling that because Toulouse will go all the way to the finals of wherever they go, that he might miss out on the chance of a tour of the in France. He's one of a triumvirate of young centres that are really coming through for France at the moment, so he's really worth watching. The suggestion is that he probably will miss out a little bit there, but my God, there's a generation of
there's so a good moment where I think he bundled Ross Vincent into touch.
He did.
And was so happy about it, he like screamed in his face.
He stood over him, yeah.
He was so up for it.
Yeah, no, he was awesome. But I've got Finn Baxter. I'm taking Finn Baxter.
I thought you might.
Watching the way that he took on bigger, heavier, more experienced tight heads opposite him with skill and heart, and to play 70 minutes in that heat yeah, he gets God of the Week for me.
So my little, and I often do like an honourable mention, which is basically cheating and having two answers, but we haven't really done much on Leinster, and I know there's this annual thing of, oh, they just play at home all the time. Was actually like drilling down into the detail, which I think Bernard Jackman did over the weekend. The reason why they've secured that home semi, quarter semi, is they got a very last minute try against Leicester to get them a bonus point earlier in the competition that pushed them into the right side of the seeding and then has therefore guaranteed them. So I feel like they get some respect for doing that.
Yeah,
and
you do have
Croke
to earn
Park
that.
Will be,
yeah.
You have to earn that home tie. Like,
having a match at Croke Park would be awesome as well. So also, credit to them for putting La Rochelle away as well, the bogeymen.
With Leinster as well, really quickly, because you're right, we haven't really spoken about them too much. The Nianaba effect.
Yeah.
Starting to see that.
He's quite a good coach, isn't he?
The
really?
Way they went at the breakdown, their defence, they've always kind of had the attacking
So,
layers.
Side note here, and we don't have to go into this huge debate, but we're... As part of the Rugby Writers Club, we do our like annual Personality of the Year, and we're opening voting soon to our membership. So if you are a member, then please vote, because so many people do. I have to keep count of them, and I've got special spreadsheets and everything for it. But probably
you probably quite enjoy that, though, don't you?
Yeah.
You volunteer,
and we get so many votes as well that it's sometimes like hard to keep track. But we've got sort of 400 or 500 members, so you know they're all voting. But Nienaber, I think, probably quite a big candidate for that with World Cup win, doing what he's doing with Leinster, all that as well. So, yeah, props to Leinster. But talking of props, I think I'm just going to go for the other side of the Quinn scrum and Will Collier. Like, he's going to be a big miss for them. He's going off to CAST next season. Never got a shot with England, really, as Adam Jones said, which is a couple of injuries probably put pay to that for him. But he's been a bit like Mark Lambert was for them in years gone by. Just one of those like club legends that possibly doesn't get the sort of wider recognition, but he was awesome, and Baxter benefited from him dominating his side of the scrum too.
He felt injuries, also fell foul of an England coach post 2019, decided he
Who
didn't want scrummaging tight heads. He wanted
an England coach post 2019.
So, yeah, Dan Cole didn't get picked, and Collier fell into the same bracket, I think.
So yeah, Collier,
shame.
Collier, Finn Baxter. I might just quickly mention Alex Dombrandt as well. It's a pick who you want from that Quinn's team, really, wasn't there? There were so many good performances. We mentioned Chandler Cunningham South earlier as well. But Dombrandt is one of those that I remember when he first sort of burst onto the scene in the Premiership, and he was so good, and everyone called for him to get England honours. And then he eventually got England honours and never quite felt like that jersey was his. You were never quite sure whether he had made the transition from club to international rugby. Then kind of went away, didn't get the headlines that he previously did. And you just feel like it has just become a better player now. Like, he's worked hard, he's gone under the radar, and he's still such a key part of what Quinns do. And I thought he was brilliant as well. So Quinns get a lot of nominations, unsurprisingly, really, after a 1 point 41-42 win in Bordeaux. That is it for this week on The Ruck. Thank you for listening. Make sure you follow and subscribe wherever you get your podcast from. Dims, all the best with whatever is next.
Thank you, mate. And current issue Rugby World is on shelves now. Players issue, go out and get it.
There you go. Final plug for him. And myself, Alex will be back with you a lot sooner than that. But enjoy your week. We'll see you next Monday.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.